All righty, we're underway then on session 20, page 145 of your notebook. So before we dive into the notebook, let's review where we've been. 2 weeks ago, remember we go back 2 weeks this review, 2 weeks ago when Resolution 181 was approved by the UN, the Arab attacks immediately began on Jewish settlements, on the kibbutzim, on the moshavim, etc. So this is just a general photo portraying the fact of Israeli defenders defending their territory. So that began immediately. The Arabs began planning for the destruction of Israel. General Sir Ismail Safwat Pasha from Iraq was named as the head general, the top guy for the Arab armies to push Israel into the sea. His field commander was our good friend Fawzi al-Kawukji, who was part of the rebellions in 1936 against the British. And so as the Arab attacks immediately commenced with the beginning of Resolution 181, the roads were cut from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The roads were cut from Haifa to the Western Galilee, from Tiberias to the Eastern Galilee, from Afula down the Beit Shan Valley. And of course, that shows that the Israeli settlements, the kibbutzim and the moshavim and the villages, were all getting cut off, and soon the settlements in the Negev were cut off as well. So Israel was definitely under siege. At that same time, we saw that the Palestine refugee movement began. Basically, a volunteer exodus of Arabs, Palestinians, from the territory we call Israel today, from Haifa and from Nazareth. Many went north up into Lebanon, from Jaffa. Many refugees left, and in the south from Beersheba. All these refugees were leaving voluntarily to get out of the way of the fighting. And the result was the UN refugee camps that were set up. And again, you have this map in your notebook. All the little triangles are the refugee camps that were started in 1947, 1948, and remain to this day. Remember, they remain to this day. The Arab countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, etc., have never allowed the Palestinian refugees to assimilate into the countries that they fled to, even though these are all Arab peoples. So here's a picture of some of the Arab refugees on foot heading for an Arab country, another photograph of that. And I found this picture on the web recently. Here's a picture of 1948 of the Khan Yunis refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. And remember, when the refugee camp started, they had to be thrown up quickly, so they were tent cities. And you can see at this 1948, this is a tent city. But again, as the refugees stayed there year after year after year after year, the tenor of the tent cities began to change. They got bigger. Here's a bigger one. And this is a picture in 1971 of the new Amman refugee camp in eastern Jordan. You see all the little Palestinian kids posing for the picture, but I want to draw your attention to the refugee camp behind them. No longer is it a tent city, but semi-permanent wooden buildings have been put up for the refugees. Well, it didn't stop there. The refugees have still been kept in these camps as political fodder for the Arab countries, and now here's a modern refugee camp. This is the Palestine refugee camp, Jabal al-Hussein in Jordan, and now it is a semi-permanent or permanent refugee city. And that's what we have today, these refugee cities. These people are still kept in squalor without any rights, unable to get into the country that they went to. So the refugee situation is pretty sad. We then entered into a theological review. I wanted to go over the material I'd covered for you earlier. First of all, we answered the question, what is Zion? That's on page 9 of your notebook. Then we answered the question, what is Zionism? Also on page 9 of your notebook. We talked about the Abrahamic covenant, page 13 of your notebook, and especially about the land covenant. That's the key covenant we were talking about, again on page 13 of your notebook. We did a quick overview of the land covenant and saw that it has four distinct aspects to it. It's a distinct covenant. It deals primarily with Israel's history of disobedience. That disobedience leads to a worldwide dispersion eventually, and then in that worldwide dispersion, repentance, which leads to the fourth stage, which is restoration, which will be the Messianic Kingdom. We also looked at the curses of the Mosaic Covenant, because unbelieving Jewish people and Israel still live under the curses and blessings of the Mosaic Covenant. We work through all those curses because we have not been characterized by obedience, but rather by disobedience. And we saw that our class fits right here on the time frame. On the timeline, we fit right between the first worldwide dispersion and the first worldwide regathering, followed by the second worldwide dispersion and the second worldwide regathering during the tribulation period. So that's on page 26 of your notebook. We also define the times of the Gentiles on page 33, where the times of the Gentiles consists of Jerusalem being trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That began in 586 BC with Babylon destroying Jerusalem, and Jerusalem has now been trodden down by the Gentiles, by the Babylonians, by the Medo-Persians, by the Greeks, by the Romans, and even today Jerusalem is still under the Gentile thumb or heel, because this time period does allow for temporary times of Jewish control over Jerusalem, like the Maccabean period, and we have semi-control over Jerusalem today. Eastern Jerusalem is still under the control of the Arab peoples, basically. So that will come to an end during the tribulation, and Jerusalem will once again fall under total Gentile domination. So that's the times of the Gentiles on page 33. We then looked at the principle of expansion and contraction. If Israel is obedient, our experiencing the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant and the land covenant will be experienced as our borders are increased and we occupy more and more of the land that has been promised. But if we're disobedient, God will squeeze us off the land. If we continue to be disobedient, he will send us into diaspora. And that's what occurred in our ancient history with the Babylonian exile and the first worldwide dispersion by the Romans in AD 70. Then under our modern chart of our expansion and contraction of our possession of the land, the same thing is happening. And we will not possess all of the promised land till the bottom of the chart with the second worldwide regathering and the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. We will then possess all the land that we have been promised. You remember, Israel, the Jewish people, have never possessed all of the promised land. We do not do so today. We only possess maybe 30 to 40% of it today. So that possession remains for the future. Remember, we talked about the fact that there are two worldwide regatherings predicted in Scripture, page 26. The first worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment that will be experienced during the tribulation period. And that's the worldwide regathering we're studying here in our class today. We finished up by looking at prophetic events that have taken place on page 35. These three prophetic events had to occur before the next one can occur. World War I and World War II, the reestablishment of the State of Israel, Jerusalem under Jewish control. That will be followed by events that have not taken place. The next major prophetic event we should expect to take place is the Russian invasion of Israel, Ezekiel 38 and 39. That will lead to a one-world government. The one-world government will collapse into the 10-kingdom worldwide government. From the 10 kingdoms will rise the Antichrist. There will be a period of peace and false security. And then the Antichrist will sign a 7-year covenant with Israel, and that will begin the tribulation period. Mankind will finally have reached the line in the sand that God has drawn and step over it. Remember, God is a very patient individual, but he does draw a line in the sand, and he says, okay, that's enough, no more. And that's when the tribulation period will begin, when we sign that 7-year covenant with the Antichrist. And then there are prophetic events that cannot be chronologically arranged on page 35. The rapture of the church can occur at any moment. We don't know when. Worldwide blackout will occur sometime prior to the tribulation. We don't know when. Elijah will return sometime prior to the tribulation, but we have no idea when. The third temple will go up. We don't know when it will go up, but it has to be up and running by the middle of the tribulation. That's all we know. So these are other events that we may see in our lifetime. And then last week, we finished up by looking at part one of the five-part documentary, Israel, A Nation is Born, hosted by former Foreign Minister Abba Iban. And that brings us to where we pick up the material today. So we're at page 145, and point four in your outline, our last major division of your notebook, the State of Israel, the modern State of Israel, the unending war, 1948 to the present. 1948 to the present. So this all deals with Israel present. All right, we ready to dive in? Everybody at page 145? All righty. So 1948, the proclamation of the State of Israel. At 8 o'clock in the morning, May 14th, 1948, the British lowered the Union Jack in Jerusalem. That's 8 o'clock in the morning. By mid-afternoon, the same day, full-scale fighting had erupted throughout the country. As soon as the British were out of there, the Arabs started attacking. At 4 p.m., this is the end of the same day, the country is already at war. Okay? The Jewish population, except for Jerusalem, which was without electricity, heard the proclamation ceremonies as they were broadcast from the Tel Aviv Museum. And you have this picture on page 145. There's Ben-Gurion and the, I think it's 37 founding fathers of the modern State of Israel. Their country is just being born. It is at war already. And they have the chutzpah, the guts, to stand in that room and pronounce the beginning of the State of Israel. They're putting their lives on the line, aren't they? You know, the beginning of the modern State of Israel is very, very similar to the beginning of the United States, isn't it? You know, we wrote our Declaration of Independence and our signers signed it. Their lives were on the line. Yes?
And who's our friend in the picture, in the portrait?
That's Herzl up in there, yeah. That's Herzl. Theodor Herzl is the big portrait. Yeah, getting far more credit than he deserves. Say again? He did, huh? Interesting. All righty. So it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The State of Israel is declared. Ben-Gurion reads the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel. And here's a close-up of David Ben-Gurion reading that declaration. Here is a picture of the document itself. It's a very long document. And of course, this is a horizontal picture. It's a vertical document, so I can only show a little bit of it for you. But if you'll turn to page 146, the beginning of that document is all written out there for you in English. And the Declaration of the State of Israel starts on page 146, continues on page 147, and finishes up on page 148. So you can read the Declaration of Independence. Now, here is the headlines in the newspaper that day. The State of Israel is born. And do you note the newspaper?
Yeah, Palestine.
The newspaper is the Palestine Post. It still exists today, known as the Jerusalem Post. And there's the modern Jerusalem Post website edition there. So it started out as the Palestine Post. It is now the Jerusalem Post. This newspaper has been part of Israel since the beginning, since before the beginning. Yes. Well, I don't know who exactly wrote it, but I don't think there was any surprise in regard to getting it together and having time to read it. They were looking at an independent state long before it happened. So, okay. But yeah, I don't know who wrote it in particular, whether it was a committee or one individual. Yes. Be just before, right. They were still doing the final draft of it. Yes, that's true. That's true. All right, so there's the Jerusalem Post, formerly known as the Palestine Post. So immediately after adopting the Declaration of Independence, the Council of State unanimously passed an ordinance abolishing the White Paper of 1939. Remember that White Paper? In other words, no more restrictions on immigration, no more restrictions on land purchase allowed. We are our own independent country. Now, bottom of page 148, on just above the U.S. recognizes Israel, you can see the signatures of all the founding fathers of the modern state there. Yes, and there's a lady there too. Yes, all the founding fathers and mothers, okay? Okay, U.S. recognizes Israel, May 14, 1948. On May 14th, President Truman decided to extend recognition to the State of Israel. That announcement was issued at 6:10 p.m. And that was against the advice of the anti-Israel State Department. Our State Department was telling him, don't do this, don't do this, don't do it, and he did it anyway. So God puts the right man in at the right time. It only takes one person, doesn't it? In the right position. One person and God is a majority. I think of Esther, right? Queen Esther, right person at the right time is a majority. And so Truman was put in place by the Lord for maybe not for only for this issue, but he was very key in the formation of the modern state. All right, page 149. Six Arab states invade. Now, I've headed that section, six Arab states. Now, as you read other historians, there's some confusion over the number of Arab states. Some say five, some say seven, some say eight. I stuck with six, and I'll show you probably why there's some confusion. It depends on how the historian, what he considers an army. So we'll, for our class, six Arab states invade. The Arab nations had discussed the possibility of armed invasion as early as June 9, 1946, you know, 2 years earlier. However, the aims of each Arab state was different. Abdullah of Transjordan, his ambition was primarily to extend his dynasty to the Arab sector of the UN plan, basically the West Bank, and he was willing to arrange his own deal with the Jews for the rest of the country. Basically, he just wanted the Dome of the Rock. He wanted authority over the Muslim religious area there, religious site. The Syrians, they were determined to seize as much as they could of northern Palestine. The Mufti's aims were the simplest of all. Remember this guy? Remember Haj Amin al-Husseini? You know, he's the number one antagonist against the modern state of Israel, great buddy of Adolf Hitler. Okay, remember him? All right, he had the simplest aims. His aim was to drive the Jews out of Palestine and rule the country. That's it. The rest, Lebanon and Iraq, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, by and large, were not interested in intervention. The Arab blueprint for invasion therefore deteriorated into a loose understanding that the Iraqis would enter north-central Palestine on the flank of the Arab Legion. The Syrian brigade would enter southeast of Tiberias, while the northern sector would be left to the Lebanese. And the Egyptians would be responsible for the southern half of Palestine. Now, the morning class asked for this map, so I'll be providing this map for you. So let's take a look at these Arab armies that invade. First of all, to the south. We'll move from south to north. In the south, we have the Egyptian army entering the Negev and going up the Gaza Strip. As we move north, we have the Jordanian army entering and heading for Jerusalem. Of course, that was Hussein's goal. He wanted to primarily control the Dome of the Rock and that religious and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the Jordanians entered there. Their army was the Jordanian Legion that had been trained and led by the British. Moving north, we come to the Iraqi army. The Iraqis entered Israel about the middle of the Jordan River, the Jordan Valley, where the Beit Shan Valley comes in. So they entered right about there, Iraq. North of them, the Assyrian armies would attack, and they were interested in the Galilee, basically the Eastern Galilee. And then to the west of the Galilee, we had the Arab Liberation Army coming down, and to the west of them, the Lebanese probes as well. So those are the six armies that invaded Israel during the War of Independence and where they entered the land. Now, this chart probably shows you why there's some confusion regarding the number of Arab states that invaded. This is just a summary of the two nations' military. First of all, on the left-hand side, Israel, before the 26th of May, 1948, their military consisted of the Haganah, the Palmach, the Irgun, and Lehi. Remember all those divisions of the army? But after May 26, 1948, all that had coalesced into the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, and there was a minorities unit there as well. The Arab states, you have Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, all Palestine, and Lebanon. And then there were some irregular armies. The Holy War Army and the Arab Liberation Army attacked as well. And then as we go to the second part of the chart, Israel also had some volunteers, some foreign volunteers called the Mahal. But the Arab states had plenty of foreign volunteers as well. Note, the Muslim Brotherhood. And they are still trying to destroy the state of Israel. The Muslim Brotherhood, volunteers from Saudi Arabia, volunteers from Yemen, volunteers from Pakistan, and from the Sudan. So because of the great variety of Arab military people that were in the invasion, that's probably why historians were confused or view the armies that invaded on different terms. I thought I'd show you the inspiring logo of the Arab Liberation Army, huh? There it is. You can see their aim, pure and simple, a knife through the heart of the Jewish state. That's their logo, a knife through the heart of the Jewish state. Destroy the nation of Israel. All righty. All right, well, let's move on then. On May 14th, Abdullah appointed himself commander-in-chief by virtue of his army's recognized military superiority in the Arab world. But the title was purely honorific. Coordination among the various Arab armies was non-existent. If they had coordinated, they would have destroyed Israel. The Arabs would have been considerably less hesitant to invade Palestine had they known the actual state of the Jewish defenses. As late as May 12th, the Haganah mobilized nearly 30,000 men and women. The number itself was perhaps not much smaller than the total Arab forces on the Palestine front. The Arab forces consisted of approximately 10,000 Egyptians, 4,500 Arab legionnaires, 7,000 Syrians, 8,000 Iraqis, and 3,000 Lebanese. That totals to be 32,500. So about the same number of fighting forces on either side. The Arab strength was concentrated primarily in much greater firepower and the air forces at their disposal. Now, at the beginning of the war, the Israelis had nothing comparable. The Jews' most important resource was to be found in the dedication and military experience of the troops, not to mention the Lord. Yes. All right? This is an improbable victory that should never have happened. But we'll see that the improbable is possible with the Lord, right? The impossible is possible with the Lord. All right, Yigal Yadin was Israel's commander of operations. Now, this is his pictures on page 149. Yigal Yadin, he also became a very well-known archaeologist as well. So he was Israel's commander of forces. On May 14th, Jewish manpower resources were critically limited, so was the supply of weapons. On May 16th, a Syrian column of 200 armored vehicles and 45 tanks. All right, this is no minor operation, is it? 200 armored vehicles, 45 tanks moved toward the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. The target was the cluster of lush, prosperous Jewish settlements found on both sides of the Jordan River. Several of them were overrun. The column then proceeded to attack Degania, the oldest kibbutz in Israel. Remember we talked about Degania when it got started? All right, here is a map. On the right, you see the box. On the left, you see that rectangle. That rectangle is enlarged on the right. And there you can see Degania, right at the very bottom, the very southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. And so these 200 armored vehicles and 45 tanks come down the Golan Heights and they reach Degania. Here is a picture of the Ganya today. You can see the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee there. This is the Ganya today, a little tiny kibbutz. Little tiny kibbutz there nestled along the lakeside. Not much to it, is there? All right. Now, without artillery, the Jewish forces were helpless to block the Syrian advance. Until then, the only weapons that had been unloaded at Haifa were four howitzers of the type used by the French army in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. These are 80-year-old howitzers. 80 years old. Two of these ancient field pieces were promptly dismantled and rushed to Degania. The local commander, Lieutenant Colonel who? Moshe Dayan. There's Moshe, our one-eyed commander. Moshe Dayan. He was born at Degania, right? The local commander, Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan, had them reassembled at the very moment the first Syrian tanks rumbled through the kibbutz perimeter. They fired off one of those cannon and they scored a direct hit on the advance tank. Had the Syrians known that these two obsolete weapons represented half the arsenal of Jewish field guns, they might have pressed the attack. Instead, the armored vehicles, 45 tanks and 200 armored vehicles, swung around and in their tracks and clattered back up the mountain road, back up the Golan Heights, and they never returned. Now, you think that was just some kind of coincidence? I think the Lord put the fear of God in the hearts of these Arabs. You know, I mean, this is crazy. 200 tanks, and you don't press the attack on this tiny little kibbutz? And all 44 of those tanks fled back up to the Golan Heights, and the one that was hit remained behind, and there it is in Degania today. This is the tank that they hit, probably shell-shocked or killed all the operators of that tank, but there it is on the grounds of Degania today. The one tank that did not retreat. Yes, Bonnie.
It just reminds me of all those times in the Old Testament when
yes. Right, exactly. Yeah, reminds you of the Old Testament, doesn't it? Right, exactly. Yep. So yeah, you think of some of the battles that David and others fought, where the enemy just retreated or killed themselves or attacked themselves or whatever, you know. So anyway, I think the Lord really worked quite a miracle there. Now the Iraqis proved only barely more effective than the Syrians. Their contingent stationed in Transjordan near the frontier numbered 8,000, of which 3,500 were combat troops. An effort was launched to cross the Jordan River opposite Beit Shan the day the mandate ended. It failed. 5 days later, however, a Jewish frontal attack on Jenin itself was driven back by the Iraqi reinforcements. A second Jewish effort failed 2 days later. Remarkably, the Iraqis were unwilling to counterattack. From then on, until the truce of June 11, they simply held their earlier positions. Had they continued the offensive in the early days of the war, they might well have cut the newborn Jewish state in two. But enthusiasm for battle was noticeably lacking among the Iraqi peasant conscripts. There were instances where the Jews found dead Iraqi gunners chained to their weapons. Why were they chained to their weapons? To keep them from fleeing, to keep them at their posts. You know? The most critical battle areas of the war proved to be in the south, along the Egyptian line of invasion up the coast, and in the Judean hills where the Arab Legion laid siege to Jerusalem. Now, let's see. I've got a quarter too. So we're going to come now to the battle of Kibbutz Yad Mordechai. So we can take that up after the break. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar, and we'll be back here in 15 minutes. All righty, we're back underway. And we're on page 150. Or getting close to page 150. All right. Brigadier Mohammed Naguib was the commander of the 2nd Egyptian Brigade. Here's a picture of Brigadier General Mohammed Naguib. So he was in charge of the 2nd Egyptian Brigade. He commanded 5,000 troops, and he proceeded cautiously up the coastal road toward Tel Aviv. The Egyptians then encountered unexpectedly stiff resistance from the isolated little kibbutz of Yad Mordechai. So here's a map. You see the on the left, the rectangle is enlarged on the right. So on the left there, the Egyptian armored column comes up through the Gaza Strip. And as they come up through the Gaza Strip, they run smack dab into kibbutz Yad Mordechai, located right there. Yad Mordechai withstood 5 days of intensive Egyptian shelling before being evacuated. Those 5 days tied up approximately half of Naguib's coastal force and mauled one of his five battalions so thoroughly that it had to be deactivated temporarily. Now here is a picture from Yad Mordechai. If you visit, I was at Yad Mordechai in 1995. And they have left some of the defenses in place, as you can see, and they have on display some weapons of the period as well. So you can see their defensive setup. And then off in the field, there's some Egyptian armored vehicles. And then they've taken these steel silhouettes and carved these, or created these steel silhouettes of Egyptian soldiers advancing, you know, charging on kibbutz Yad Mordechai, to give you a feel of what the defenders put up with for those 5 days. It was quite an amazing battle in the war. And when I went there, I didn't know what to expect. You know, we just walked out onto this area, and I stood right about in this spot and looked out over this battlefield. You know what happened to me? I instantly went back to Vietnam, just that fast. Boom, boom. I stood there, I looked at that, I turned around and had to walk away. I just couldn't look at it. So I haven't been back to Yad Mordechai since, but that's the view. I saw that and I said, yeah, that's the same as it was when I was there. Now, if you want to read about the battle at Yad Mordechai, there was a book written by Margaret Larkin. You can get it on Amazon.com. The 6 days of Yad Mordechai. Quite an amazing, amazing defense there of the southern part of the state of Israel. And this picture is the water tower at Yad Mordechai. It's left there exactly where it fell and exactly in the state it was in during the battle as a memorial to all that happened there. But they tied up the Egyptian army. That was the critical issue. Yad Mordechai stopped Nagui pretty much in his tracks for 5 days. Several miles away, another kibbutz, Negba, was blocking the Egyptian advance with an equally ferocious resistance. The Egyptian, that's Naguib, eventually decided to skirt the bristling farm community, and Negba remained a continual threat on his flank. Now, he moved with elaborate caution, slowing his drive 16 miles from the outskirts of Tel Aviv. Now, this time, Yadin decided to risk a tactical offensive. On May 29th, he ordered reinforcements from the Jerusalem corridor to circle Naguib's positions at night and attack the Egyptians from the rear. With troop strength barely half that of the invaders, the relief force nevertheless found darkness and surprise very effective. The Egyptians were thrown into confusion by the unexpected descent upon their flank. Now, Yadin exploited the disarray by calling a press conference and announcing that the Egyptian supply lines had been cut by overwhelming concentrations of Israeli troops. The news was immediately dispatched over the international wire services and eventually reached Cairo. As Yadin had hoped, The Egyptian high command accepted the story at face value. Never believe a reporter, you guys. Never believe a reporter. They accepted the story at face value, and they radioed Naguib to pull up short. The bewildered commander dutifully followed orders. And Naguib's setback proved to be the turning point of the Egyptian invasion. Tel Aviv was never in jeopardy again. Again, very improbable, right, that the Egyptian high command would believe a news report instead of getting hard evidence. You know, but they did. The Jewish situation in the Jerusalem area, besieged by Transjordan's Arab Legion, was even more precarious. The Arabs controlled every height around the city and within it. Their fighting strength was then nearly 4,500 armed men, while the Jews, if numerically their equal, were virtually without weapons. So now we're at the battle for Jerusalem. And if you're interested in reading in detail about the Battle of Jerusalem, this is the book I would recommend, O Jerusalem, by Collins and LaPierre, available on Amazon.com. Collins and LaPierre were both newspaper reporters, so they know how to write, and they did a great job of researching out all that happened. So whether this is in our library or not, I don't know. It might be in our library. But it's a classic work on the Battle for Jerusalem in 1948. Collins and LaPierre, O Jerusalem. Get it on Amazon. Great resource for you. Now on May 19th, Abdullah sent his first units into the old city. Simultaneously, an additional 2,000 legionnaires, well equipped with artillery and commanded by British officers. Now, the British were not involved in the battles here, but they did train the Jordanians, and they did lead the Jordanians. The British officers moved on Jerusalem from the north and soon besieged its outlying perimeter. Now, here's a map. You have this map on page 151 of Jerusalem, the triangular crosshatched area. And what we're talking about is this area here, the northern boundary of Jerusalem. This is where the Jordanian legion was attacking. After 10 days of savage fighting, the outnumbered Jewish troops finally managed to drive the legion back from this point of furthest advance into the Mea Shearim quarter. On May 28th, the British commander, this is Sir John Glubb, decided to call off the attack in the northern part of the city. Page 152. Some of the companies had lost fully half of their effective strength, and others were unnerved by the shattering blast of homemade Jewish mortars. From this point on, the Arabs switched their offensive to Jerusalem's southern approaches. On May 2nd, under cover of a heavy Transjordanian artillery bombardment, Egyptian infantrymen stormed the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel, lying astride the entrance to southern Jerusalem. And again, you have this map on page 152, and Ramat Rachel, here's the kibbutz to the south, right at the southern gateway to the city of Jerusalem. So now the Jordanians are attacking Ramat Rachel.
So this is before the invasion?
No, this is the war of
1948. Right. This is May 2nd.
May 2nd, interesting. Well, they had started early, yeah. Yeah, they had started a little early there, I guess.
Is there a number missing?
Like I might have a number missing. Yeah, May 28th is what I have before that. I'll check on that number then. It could be my typo there.
Oh.
All right, okay. I'm allowed 3 a year. I'll look. Yeah, well, the day before is May 28th. So this is probably after May 28th, okay? All righty, so I'm allowed 3 mistakes a year, and we are now 2. This is my second mistake. But typos don't count. 7,000 typos I'm allowed. 7,777. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean, the Salem, I think? Is
City of Peace, basically, is what it means. Yeah. Salem comes from the word shalom, peace. Yeah. Alrighty, so sometime in May, under cover of a heavy Transjordanian artillery bombardment. Infantrymen stormed the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel, lying astride the entrance to the southern Jerusalem. What followed was the single most furious encounter of the war. The little kibbutz changed hands 5 times during the next 4 days. The soldiers pressing forward to bayonet attack often had to climb over bodies piled on top of each other. But when the last attack was over, the Israeli troops, most of them former Etzel members, remained in control. And for the moment, at least, the imminent possibility of the Arabs capturing the new city had faded. However, the Jewish quarter failed to hold out. On May 28th, the Jewish quarter surrendered. And here is a picture of Jewish refugees fleeing the Jewish quarter by the Zion Gate. And if you've been to Jerusalem, you have probably walked through the Zion Gate. But it was a moment of tremendous anxiety and panic at that time. Yes.
May 21st.
May 21st. Okay, so correct that. May 21st instead of May 2nd there. May 21. All right. Thank you. All righty. My mistake. All right. On May 28th, the Jewish quarter surrendered. News of the fall of the old city was received with profound shock by the Yishuv. The loss of the Western Wall and the temple site was lamented with bitterness for years to come. The Arabs thus far had been unable to conquer the sprawling urban complex through direct assault. By the opening of June, nevertheless, the ability of the metropolitan area to hold out was far from certain. The prospect of mass starvation was very real. So Ben-Gurion insisted that the full military priority would be given to opening the Jerusalem highway. Now here is the man put in charge of that, Yigal Alon. Yigal Alon, his picture is on page 152. Yigal Alon was called down from the north on May 23rd to assume strategic responsibility for the assault on Latrun. There was an Arab strong point controlling the road. Now, new recruits were needed to augment the Jewish forces, including hundreds of recent immigrants possessing no military experience and even basic training. They were rushed up by bus and taxi from Tel Aviv. Some of these guys had never held a rifle in their hands before. On May 25th, under the operational command of Colonel Shlomo Shamir, the attack was launched in a blistering desert Khamsin. In other words, a Khamsin is the equivalent to the Santa Ana winds we have today. It's extremely hot and exhausting. Now, despite the lack of adequate reconnaissance or artillery support, the men were thrown into a direct frontal offensive. The Arab Legion's 4th Regiment was ensconced in the village heights, and they raked the attackers with mortars and artillery. And the Israelis were thrown back with a heavy loss of life. And during the next few days, additional efforts were mounted, and each time the same result. Latrun very nearly became the graveyard of Jewish hope for breaking the siege of Jerusalem. Now, here's a map. This map is on page 153. And of course, on the right, you can see Jerusalem, and then you just follow the road, the main road, from Jerusalem to the west. And as you go down that road, you come to Latrun on the far west there. Just above the main road and that Y in the road, the black arrows indicate that the Arabs are holding the high ground above the road and are basically controlling it. But Latrun was a graveyard for many, many Jewish people there. Now, I also ran across this article. It's not in your notes because I picked it up on January 2014 from the Times of Israel. Here's what this article reads. Left for Dead in 1948, the battle that shaped General Ariel Sharon. Battalion Commander Sharon, 20 years old, was shot in the abdomen and would have died but for the heroism of a 16-year-old soldier wounded himself who dragged him through the latrun killing fields to safety. So Ariel Sharon almost died in this battle. Can you imagine the impact on Israel had he not lived? But because he did live, the incredible impact he will have on the new state of Israel, as we will see him pop up over and over and over again. So that was quite news to me that Ariel Sharon almost died there. All right, so the siege of Jerusalem doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem possible to break it. A single alternative remained for opening the Jewish supply line. During the previous weeks, Colonel David Marcus, now, by the way, before I go on to David Marcus, here's the formidable barrier that's blocking the road to Jerusalem, the police fort at Latrun. This is where the Arabs were ensconced. And here's a picture of the Arab gunners at that police station. They were in the high ground. They were in the police station, and they raked the Jewish infantry coming up. Very inexperienced and under-armed infantry and Jewish people were slaughtered during this battle. Today, Latrun is the Armored Corps Museum. So when you visit it today, you see all kinds of armored vehicles there. Here is a formidable armor vehicle. This is an obsolete Merkava II. So the Merkava tank has constantly undergone improvement. But that is Israel's main battle tank today, the Merkava. So it's very interesting to go to Latrun today. It's quite a museum with all that armored gear all over the place. Russian tanks and British tanks and Israeli tanks, all kinds of stuff. American tanks, all kinds of stuff. All right, Colonel David Marcus. Here is a picture of him on page 153. Mickey, yes, nickname was Mickey Marcus. He was an American Jewish volunteer and West Point graduate. He was serving as area commander for the road, and he had been using a path south of Latrun and Deir Ayub to infiltrate troops on foot through the hills to Jerusalem. And by the way, you can read his story in the book called Cast a Giant's Shadow. Now, I wasn't even aware that book existed till today, but apparently we have a copy of it in our library, and it has been checked out. Yes. I don't recommend the movie. Yes, it is a movie starring Burt Lancaster as... Isn't it Burt Lancaster? Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas as Mickey Marcus. It's a bit Hollywoodized, but it's historical. It's historical. Shot on location. That's true. So if you like to see that movie, just take some of it with a grain of salt, okay? And then read the book, all right? I really recommend the book over the movie. Yeah. So anyway, you can read about Colonel Marcus in Cast the Giant Shadow or get an idea of what he did in the movie. All right, so he was using this footpath south of Latrun to infiltrate troops through the hills to Jerusalem. Now, the Deir Ayub section of the road is also known as the Bab el Wad, if you can hear it by that name as well. Now, Marcus speculated that the path might be widened to enable vehicles to pass through. Now, with Yadin's approval, hundreds of laborers were now summoned from Tel Aviv and immediately put to work clearing boulders and dynamiting rock sidings. The work on the road was named the Burma Road. And now here's a map. Now again, here's Jerusalem on your right. And follow the road down to your left. And now my red circle not only includes Latrun, but south of Latrun you see a representation of the Burma Road. This little footpath that is now going to be enlarged. And so the Israelis went to work with heavy equipment, bulldozers, etc., and began making this footpath into a genuine road. You can see the terrain there is quite steep. That's the way it is there. It's a tough place to walk.
How come the Latrun didn't hear that?
They did. The Arabs knew that was going on. Here's a picture of a Burma Road convoy. That sign, by the way, says Yerushalayim. That's pointing to Jerusalem. The Arabs were so confident, so disdainful of the Jews, figuring they could never possibly turn that into road, they didn't even bother to attack. They left them alone, basically. and they built the Burma Road, much to the surprise of the Arabs. Now, there was no opportunity to rest as they built that road, even on the fiercest heat, because the United Nations truce was to come into effect on June 11. If the Burma Road was not completed before then, no further efforts would be permitted after the truce deadline, and Jerusalem would starve. In other words, nobody would be allowed to replenish Jerusalem. Page 154. On June 9th, a primitive roadbed was cut through the Jerusalem mountains. The first trucks loaded with cans of food and water ventured out on the makeshift roadway. And several hours later, they entered Jerusalem, where they were greeted rapturously by the waiting Jewish population. And so the siege had been broken. So now we come to the first United Nations truce, page 154. The idea of a truce in the fighting was introduced and endorsed by the UN Security Council on May 20th. The chosen mediator was Count Folke Bernadotte, and you have his picture there on page 154. Here he is, Count Folke Bernadotte. He was from Sweden. He was a Swedish diplomat. He arrived in Israel the following week. And by the way, later he was assassinated, and the Stern Gang, Lehi, was suspected of doing the assassination. That was the same group that had assassinated Lord Moyne. Remember them? So they were our Jewish terrorists, our Jewish extremists. So Folke Bernadotte did not survive his trip to the Holy Land there. Now, the Arabs were generally receptive to the idea of a truce, and all fighting came to a stop on June 11th. The truce descended on the exhausted army, quote, as dew from heaven, in the words of one Israeli commander. Both sides were at the limit of their resources. Now, strategically, the Arabs had gained little. The Syrians had established a bridgehead on Israeli territory, but it was a minimal one. The Arab Legion had taken the old city, but the achievement was of questionable military importance. The Egyptians had acquired a foothold in the Negev, but that was a barren desert. And whatever pretense of a united command had ever existed among the Arab armies had disintegrated during the actual fighting. Abdullah, the Hashemite king, had lost interest in continuing the war. However, the other Arab leaders made effective use of the truce. You see, Abdullah was quite happy. He now had the Dome of the Rock, and he had basically the West Bank, so he didn't want to do anything more. But the other Arab leaders made effective use of the truce. The Iraqis increased their numbers at the front to 10,000 and added large quantities of equipment. The Syrians also carried out an extensive recruiting campaign, as did the Egyptians. By the first week in July, the number of Arab regular troops in Israel had grown from 32,000 to 45,000. Now, page 155. Gravely short of manpower and weapons, the fledgling Israeli army actually was in danger of collapse on nearly every front. By the truce provisions, neither side was permitted to introduce new troops. Jerusalem was to be allowed enough food and water for a month, but no more. The Israeli high command had no intention of abiding by these conditions, which they considered suicidal. And of course, the Arabs weren't abiding by it either. So convoys of food and medicine were rushed to Jerusalem. Mobilization was continued and increased dramatically in early July. Little armaments factories moved into full production, turning out bullets, grenades, and mortar shells. Weapons were secretly unloaded at coastal sites. By then, the quantity of guns and equipment had become more substantial. On May 20th, the Czechoslovakian government turned over an entire military airfield to the Jews, which in the following months became Israel's principal base in Europe for the shuttle service of arms and planes. So several Dakota transports, commuted back and forth between the two nations, ferrying to Israel dismantled fighter planes, artillery pieces, armored vehicles, and lighter weapons and ammunitions. Planes arrived from other countries as well, including bombers and fighters flown illegally by veterans of the Allied Air Forces out of Britain and the United States. Thousands of tons of ammunition, military equipment, and clothing now arrived. Much of it purchased, much of it donated from Jewish sources throughout the world. The French government also supported Israel. Weapons were sold in large quantities to the Jews. Training, storage, assemblage facilities were provided near French arms depots and at abandoned French Air Force landing strips. Airfields in Corsica were made available to planes refueling en route to Israel. In Israel, Ben-Gurion was determined to impose unity and discipline at all levels of the military effort. So uniforms became standard, and a differential pay scale was established for commissioned officers. During the month-long truce, now notice, you guys, this is 30 days, a month-long truce, 30 days and this is happening. Weapons and supplies are flowing into Israel like a flood. Can you imagine what was going on there? Been interesting to be part of that. During the month-long truce, new recruits were given intensive training. New weapons were mastered. With 60,000 men in service and growing quantities of European and American fighting equipment at its disposal, the army was systematically transformed into a modern fighting force. 30 days to create an army. Is that believable? If you told them that the IDF as a modern fighting force was created in 30 days, would anybody believe you? Yeah, so this, taking apart and putting together airplanes and all that stuff. Yeah, had to be transported in some way, had to be disassembled. Amazing. All right, so the map here, and you have this map on page 159. The map shows the situation when the first UN truce went into effect. The status after the first United Nations truce is the jet black area, the solid black area. So the nation of Israel is quite small at that time. Just a solid black area. The solid black area. So political attempts to squeeze the state out of existence had failed, but now a military attempt to squeeze the state out of existence had failed as well. God is sovereign, isn't he? If he wants to establish his state, he will do it. All right, Israel offensive. Israel offensive. As the truce period approached its end, the Egyptians prepared to strike the first blow. On July 8th, before the truce expired, General Naguib renewed the attack against Negba, the main cohesive element of the Israeli defense system in the south. But Negba, too, had been reinforced with heavy equipment during the truce and now successfully hurled back repeated Egyptian assaults. Thereupon, the Jews themselves began a limited offensive, reoccupying a number of villages in the northwest corner of the Negev and forcing back the main Egyptian line at the center. Page 156. It soon became evident to Yadin and his staff that the Egyptians no longer represented a serious offensive threat, and they would be dealt with at a more opportune time later on. Now, in the north, the Syrians were content to dig in at the captured farm settlement of Mishmar HaYarden. The presence of 2,000 Arab irregulars under Fawzi al-Kuqji in the northern Galilee mountains was a more serious potential danger. The Jews disposed of it, however, in a brutal week-long campaign during which they overran the Arab town of Nazareth and cleared the surrounding Arab villages. At the same time, the principal Israeli military effort was concentrated on the Legion-occupied Lida-Ramla area. This area was also dominated Israel's major road junctions north, south, and east, west, including the opening of the Jerusalem corridor and the country's one major airport. On July 9, Yigdal alone led two of his brigades in an attack on the Arab strongpoint. In the course of a day and a night of fighting, the enemy positions were completely encircled. On the 11th, Lida and its international airport fell to Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan's mechanized infantry. The following afternoon, Dayan led his column of troops into Ramla. Barreling through the main street at full speed, machine guns firing, Dayan's troops sent the legionnaires fleeing. So So with this sledgehammer operation, the Jews eliminated any remaining Arab threat to the Tel Aviv area. Second UN truce. The UN Security Council unanimously endorsed a second ceasefire proposal on July 15th with instructions for hostilities to cease in 3 days. By July 18, Israel occupied far more of the land than the UN partition resolution had allocated, while the Arabs occupied only one Jewish settlement, Mishmar HaYarden, and the small Egyptian foothold in the Negev. And again, on our map, this is the status after the second United Nations truce. The jet black area is the first truce, but now the dark gray area is the area conquered by the Israelis by the time of the second UN truce. So the area occupied by Israel has now increased to an area actually larger than what was allocated during the partition plan. All right, this brings us to the Negev liberated on page 156. And I see that our time is over. So we'll pick up the battle for independence, the War of Independence, next week with the liberation of the Negev. So let's go ahead and call it quits. Let me pray, and then we'll turn you loose. Father, again, I'm just kind of struck by the fact that you are in charge. Your will get done one way or another. You will see to it that your will is accomplished. And mankind can't stay in the way of it. We can't prevent it. All it takes is one person and you. And your will we see here has been accomplished. Help us always to remember that, Lord, that you and one person is a majority, no matter what comes against us. And that just as you oversaw the reinstatement of the nation of Israel, so you oversee our lives, even during the dark times. Help us to remember from this little bit of history that you care for your people and that you work on their behalf. And even though the situation may seem impossible, we know that your will be done. And help us to rest in that. And we ask you to help us do that in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, so we'll see you next week.